Hello, listeners. I'm Martin Kessler, and I'm joined today by returning guests, heretic John Cribbs, and Bunwellian conservative Christopher Funderburg. Thank you for joining me.
Hey, Martin.
Thank you for having us on, Martin.
Thank you for coming on and for pitching this topic, which is, I guess, specifically the theme of religion in Louise Bunuel's films, right?
I think there are these four movies. Three of them are almost a trilogy. It's Viridiana, Nazarene, and Simon of the Desert. And I think John and I wanted to talk about them, but it feels weird to talk about Bunuel's most religiously focused stuff and not also talk about the Milky Way.
Of course.
So I think that was my thought a little bit on it, John. I don't know about you. Again, this is like the Neil Jordan Seaside Trilogy episode we did, where it's like, well, John and I didn't really discuss what the idea was.
The trilogy of six. And...
Yeah.
But I think we're both on the same page. I think you're right about those three films being like a trilogy, even though technically Nazarene is not part of the Gustavo Alatriste Sylvia Pinal trilogy. You know, Exterminating yeah. Angel would be the third one of those. But they feel more linked, I think, than any of his films. But it's definitely important to talk about Milky Way too, even though it came later and it's part of his, you know, his late French masterpieces. I think absolutely thematically, you got to talk about it.
And it's also like, in some ways, it's like the key to, you know what I mean? Like, let me explain a little more clearly what I'm thinking about religious stuff. I think with the Milky Way too, it's sort of like, it's almost like the cliff notes for understanding these other three movies.
Right. Cause Milky Way, it has this, it's a pretty loose structure, but it's a little bit more structured than some of the last couple, where you have these two hitchhikers going along this ancient pilgrimage trail, and it's interrupted by these little vignettes, which are sort of little dialogues or jokes or things that just kind of ruminate on religion from different perspectives, and you sort of feel like it's working through and maybe coming towards some sort of statement about religion. And I think the screenwriter Carrier said, Bunuel said, I want to make a film just about heresy. This movie's all about heresy. So he said he went back and started researching the history of the heretical. And you can almost feel that as the film jumps through different time periods and different ideas of what's heretical. In some cases, it's pretty extreme. In some cases, it's like sort of esoteric what qualifies as heresy. Yeah.
And also one thing that I think is interesting, important to point out, he takes a lot of quotes from the Bible and like literalizes little scenes around them. Mm-hmm. And those quotes are things that to Bunuel feel like heresies, like where there's the beggars and the rich man says to them, do you have anything? Do you have any money? To the two beggars, and one's like, I have nothing, and the other one's like, I have a little. And the rich man gives nothing to the guy with nothing and a lot of money to the guy who already has a little, which is a play on a quote from the Bible of, you know, to the effect of those who have nothing shall receive nothing, those who have some will receive much, right? Which is like, to Bunuel, that's like, that seems fucking heretical that's in the Bible, you know? And there's a few other instances like that in the Bible.
I think it even ends with like a disclaimer that this is in the Bible.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think too that what's important with Milky Way and why it's such a footnote to the rest of his movies is that someone could watch Viridiana or they could watch Nazarene and kind of get the wrong idea about what Bunuel feels about religion and about Catholicism.
Yeah.
And when it comes to Milky Way, taking on heresy specifically, or the way Carrier says it, credo quia absurdum, which is, you know, the belief that because the dogma is absurd, with my limited intelligence, I don't understand it, therefore it must come from God, right? And so the heretic replaces something in the dogma that doesn't make sense with something of his own, which I think is kind of what Bunuel does, right? I mean, I think mm-hmm. Bunuel is interested in the mystery of religion, the things that can't be known. And he's interested in exploring those things within the modern world or the contemporary world.
Right. You have that line with the priest who turns out to be mad and taken away. But when he says religion without mystery is no religion, like there have to be things that you don't understand that have to be a little bit absurd, like the transubstantiations, what I think they were talking about, or, you know, a few other questions.
Yeah, well, what is the literal relationship of Jesus's body to the communion, you know? Is it literally his body, or is Jesus's body in it like pate, Yeah.
Right. The nature of the Eucharist and the divinity of Christ. Was he a man or was he a God? Yeah. Was, you know, the Virgin Mary really a virgin? Yeah. All those things, you know, exploring them, though, I think these heresies as things that you have to kind of look at as religion definitely helps if you go, when you go back to a movie like Simon of the Desert and see what Boonwell specifically was interested in.
Yeah.
Well, you have the little girl asking, like, after the man's hands are restored miraculously, like, are those your original hands or those new hands? And he sort of smacks her, like, you don't
exactly.
Have to question
yes.
this.
Then he hits her. Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that made me laugh the most in Milky Way is the head waiter who's having these little religious conversations. And
yeah.
When he's explaining to the two sub waiters about how an atheist has to be mad, and he uses the quote from the Bible as an example, and it's hilarious because, first of all, the two sub-waiters clearly tell that this argument's bullshit, and they just give each other this look, but kind of agree with him. But people use that argument in real life all the time, like, oh, like, that proves it. It says so in the Bible.
Yeah.
But the way he delivers it, it's like, ah, oh, there it is, this conclusive evidence
yeah.
that there's a God because it says so in the Bible, basically.
Right, and the way that Boonwell yeah. looks at it is to say that heresy or atheism is incorrect is wrong because, you know, and using, you know, quotes from the Bible and from dogma to prove them wrong is to completely remove the mystery from religion.
Right.
You know, to say that everything is explainable when nothing could be less explainable than God, obviously.
Yeah.
And so Boonwell basically going back through these movies, you realize he's saying, why don't we ask these questions? And aren't you interested in knowing the answers to some of these things?
Yeah, I think that's the main thing that I would say when you start talking about Boonwell and religion, as everybody knows the, like, thank God I'm still an atheist quote. And I think that, and especially from coming out of the Surrealists, that people think of him as being anti-religious mm-hmm. in some way and purely mocking religion. And that's not where he is at all. These movies have an incredible sympathy especially for a medievalist kind of religiousness, that these movies are definitely culturally Catholic, all of them. And I don't think he's out just to skewer and make fun of this stuff.
No.
You know what I mean? I don't think that's actually what his plan is, although he does plenty of that. But I think he has sympathy for humanity. I think he really likes people, and I think he likes humanity's struggles with this stuff. And the insane weird answers they come up with to these questions are interesting to him.
Definitely.
For me, that was most on display in Nazarene, where there is that gap between the church, which he's still sort of poking fun at, but, you know, he has an incredible amount of sympathy for this priest character who's basically just trying to live as well as he can, as, you know, as good a Christian as he can, as close to the life of Christ even.
He's certainly least frustrated with the priest as opposed to the other.
I think so. Like, I mean, I found a lot of sympathy for that character watching it, which, you know, like, it's to the point where it kind of turns into a joke saying, oh, like, your practices are really anti-Catholic, they're really anti-Christian, they're trying to tell him, but he's just going around trying to help people and, you know, not asking for anything that isn't his, and, you know, trying to set things right and do the right thing. Like, to them, that's like, oh, this is so anti-Catholic, you're actually dangerous.
The second half of that I'm an atheist, thank God aphorism is actually, we must seek God within man himself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that just says that Boonwell, you know, is interested in exploring, you know, a social attitude towards religion, and in Nazarene, he definitely finds it with this kind of quixotic quest of a priest to this level of asceticism where he's going to, you know, insist on being poor, insist on trying to help plague victims and things like that within a modern Mexican society when there's no use for it anymore. You know, that there's just literally no context within it to place this kind of self-sacrifice.
Yeah. You know, there's the two women following him, and there's Beatrice, who sort of thinks she loves him in a sort of religious saintly way, always a saint. And then it's not really until the end that they tell her, like, no, you're in love with him as a man.
Yeah, and she's really devastated by it. You know, it really shatters her illusion of what her relationship was. I think at the beginning we should say, too, is these three movies, what makes them a trilogy, Simon of the Desert, Viridiana, and Nazarene, they're three movies about somebody who seems to be a really good person, or, you have no reason to doubt that they're devoted to goodness, and how little good that does for them or the world is basically the story of these three people. As you have three very pious, rotten with piety, as they say in Viridiana, people who only try and do good in the world and be devoted to God, to a God sense of godliness, and it doesn't do any good. It's hard to point to any good that comes of it.
But Buñuel really cares about these characters. I think that what people mistake his films with, and again, it's being saddled as, you know, the guy who made L'Âge d'Or, mm-hmm. you know, basically to incense the audience all those years ago. People say that Buñuel's take is that people who are strongly religious are dumb.
Yeah.
But like the correct angle on that would be people who are strongly religious are tormented, and it's a torment that comes from within, you know, that it's the torment's never made clear to that specific person. Like the mocking Christ we see is, you know, Andara yep. sees that, you know, Don Nazario.
In Nazarene.
That,
yeah.
In Nazarene, yeah.
Grinning Jesus, yeah.
This scary face of Jesus, you know. But we recognize that what it is that he's in trying to be a good person, and with Viridiana as well, yep. trying to be a good person and do the right thing. They are basically being tormented by it, the people not accepting that goodness.
I mean, Viridiana, it almost struck me that it's like what you were saying about no good coming of it. She tries to, you know, help the misfortunate and takes them into this chateau that she's inherited after her molesty uncle kills himself. And
he only offended her in thought, Martin. He only possessed her in thought.
It's still creepy.
I don't think that's a corrupt... No, I'm joking. Okay. I'm, of course, joking. He's vile.
He's a weirdo.
This was a joke.
But, yes. You know, and then it goes completely awry, this little commune that she tried to make for herself. And the cousin who comes into her life, he's sort of...
Who also plays Nazarene, which should be mentioned as well.
I mean, that's a great double roles. Like, if you put the cousin next to the Nazarene characters... You know, in one, he's sort of the one who's trying to be pious, and in the other, he's sort of the devilish figure, maybe a little bit the corruptive figure, but in a positive way, I think.
Well, also Sylvia Pinal playing Vera Diana and the devil in Simon in the Desert.
Exactly. Yeah.
This big.
Yeah, I don't think he's intended as a positive character at all.
You don't think so?
And that's something when I first saw these movies. I was very, as like a teenager, and I saw Viridiana when I was like 15. It was like one of the first serious art movies I saw when I was like trying to find art movies, and I loved it. And so I sought out Simon of the Desert and Nazarene. Oh, no, I didn't see Nazarene until later, now that I'm thinking about it. But I remember seeing Simon of the Desert, and at the end, he goes to like the rock club where there's like garage rock right, playing, and he's like, has his
music.
Hair styled like a beatnik, and... Yeah, and being really confused by it. But when I got older, I didn't understand that, because I really thought of like the liberating power of rock and roll and the rebellious power of rock and roll,
ends.
Like
yeah.
a lot of teenagers knew. Yeah, but Buñuel hates rock music. He really intended that scene as a vision of like a postmodern hell. You know, like he really meant that scene sincerely, like Devil's Music. And the same thing at the end of Viridiana with the terrible garage rock playing. And one of the things, one of the things that Buñuel is critical of and sort of laments is like the new generation's promiscuity and their detestment of silence and their love of rock music. And those are actually Buñuel's opinions. And if you take those, his personal taste and palate, and look at these films through that context, they take on a different meaning, as opposed to, it's easy to watch Viridiana and feel like, I guess she's liberated now. I guess that guy has shown her how to modernize, you know, in some way. And that's not it. It's at very best, I think it's a queasy acceptance of this is the way the world is in Viridiana, as opposed to a celebration of like, now she can have threesomes with the housemaid and her cousin or some shit that I don't know what the idea would be, what the positive vision of the end of that film is. It's like her belief in God is shattered and she almost got killed, but, you know, she can play cards like a modern lady.
There's definitely something tragic about it with Nazarene as well.
Oh,
which
yeah.
Which ends, you know, with Don Nazario being let off, having his belief in faith shattered by going to prison and being attacked by the, you know, inmates of the prison, and then being saved by a guy who was, you know, who claims to be completely godless and completely godless and an atheist. And seeing that, you know, a person who turns his back on God can be as gracious, a spirit as himself. But at the same time, I agree that with Vera Diana, I don't think he's saying it's a good thing she's been liberated from this, quixotic, take on things. Nazarin is in the same way. It's like, it's kind of a tragedy for him.
Sad when he's given the pineapple.
Yeah, that's really sad. Right.
Every time I see that, I want to cry. And it's absurd, but too.
May God be with you.
It's important to notice, too, that, you know, that he uses the sound of the Calandan drums, right? The where Boonwell grew up, they had a ritual where they would play the drums, what was it, Chris, from Good Friday into Saturday to symbolize the shadow of Christ upon his crucifixion. And it's a beautiful ritual where they drum all night. But at the same time, the sound of those drums
are stained with blood, is what he says.
Right. It's also terrifying. Its power is terrifying and crushing. And that having that sound take over the soundtrack at the end of Nazarin, he used that same sound too at the end of Lodge Door, and I think also in L and something else. You kind of are in awe of, you know, the power of those drums and sort of the kind of power, the power of religion and God, and this torment that, you know, his characters feel when they are under this obligation to be pious and towards asceticism, when they should really be part of mankind. They should, you know, they should be able to recognize their fellow man and experience those pleasures of the flesh. There's got to be a between that, you know, he's not finding.
I agree.
I mean, Simon of the Desert, it's almost like a comic take on that. You know, Simon,
who's a stylite, who stands atop a pillar and lives an ascetic life. And there was a whole rash of these type of people throughout history. And this one is somehow related to, there was a real Simon Stylites. And this character is not supposed to be him, but it's supposed to be related to some him.
But yeah,
supposed
to be his son or something. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to literally be his son in the movie, but it doesn't. The movie, I went to like the text of the movie, and the text of the movie does not make it clear.
He's like selfless to a fault.
Well, he wants to reject the physical world. He's ready. He's devoted entirely to God.
And in the case of Simon, he's literally standing above everyone. You know?
That it's a total rejection of the physical world in a very literal way.
You know, like it plays like a joke when they have the priest who had stared at the woman coming and trying to explain to him, like, what's yours or mine? And he's, oh, this is mine. He goes, okay, then keep it then. You know, like he's so...
But that's also beautiful. That's actually, I think that's a moment too where it is silly. It's that Boonwellian sense of humor.
Right.
All of these movies have it. Well, maybe not Nazarene.
It's a little more serious.
Has less humor than a lot of his work. But that Boonwell humor where he's not... If it's a joke, the joke is not necessarily intended to humiliate or ridicule or reject their line of thought. I think Boonwell is equally rejecting of almost all kind of rationalities and certainties. So to make the mistake of he's... trying to reject Christianity in favor of some other rationality that you or I might have as the smart, enlightened audience, he's not doing that either.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, he's not, oh, we're so much smarter than Simon the Desert, who's an absurd figure. It's, look at this absurd figure. He's absurd like we all are. Don't you think that's fair to say, John?
Absolutely. I think that Carlos Fuentes summed up Boonwell better than anybody when he said that he has a religious temperament without religious faith.
Yeah.
You know, I think that he is interested. He grew up with religion, obviously. He grew up in a Catholic nation where it was all around him, and it's the thing that he was brought up on. And I think that he finds it absurd that people wouldn't want to delve into these mysteries and these questions while at the same time making it a tragedy that Simon wants to put himself above everybody else, you know, that he wants to distance himself from the humanity. So it's basically two extremes where you're either close to God or you're so far away from God that you're going to break into your benefactor's house and wreck it.
Yeah.
Well, I, like, again, with Simon, what's kind of a sweet, funny moment is when he's just blessing things. Like, he blesses the little grasshopper and says, what can I bless now?
Yeah.
I'm just having a great time.
And when he says to the grasshopper, go out and spread the gospel of God to the grasshopper.
And then he's like, awesome. Oh, like, besides being a spiritual exercise, blessing's fun. It's a lot of fun. And then...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He finds the crumb in his tooth and starts to bless that. Yeah, it's great.
But then after he's blessing everything, he's like, oh, I don't realize what I'm saying. And he, like, rejects the idea that he actually enjoys blessing things. Like, that's too much pleasure for him.
Yeah.
So.
I was also going to say, just him being up on the pillar, and to tie it to Milky Way again, at the end of Milky Way, it has Jesus saying what I always find one of the most unsettling and shocking quotes in the Bible, where Jesus is saying, if you don't reject your father and your mother, and indeed your own mm-hmm. brothers and children, you cannot walk with me, nor are you fit to be my disciple.
Yeah.
Right? That's
well, and Simon kind of rejects
to be like,
his own
if you
mother,
can't,
yeah.
he rejects his mother. Yes, yeah, Simon is living that, and that feels so mm-hmm. sad to me. All of the shots of his mom, who's apparently in ill health, and he says, you can spend your last days here with me, but leave me alone, basically, is what he says to her. And then he has that fantasy of coming down to earth and running on the ground with her, and they, like, embrace and laugh, and he, like, shakes it off the way he shakes off the visions from the demons, you know? And that's so incredibly sad and bittersweet, and I think that's why it's in the Milky Way, because it feels like a heresy to Boonwell to say that something Jesus said feels like a heresy to him. And I think that there's a lot of times where he's not intending to in criticizing these ideas or making a joke of some of these ideas. It's not necessarily ridicule. I think he sees something very bittersweet and heartbreaking in some of this stuff.
Sure. I mean, I thought of that in Mexican Bus Ride. I kept thinking, you know, this doesn't feel like somebody who's entirely critical of certain religious ideas, that if you give in to temptation, maybe you won't get into heaven. You know, he sort of literalizes it by putting the heaven island, but it felt pretty sincere to me, right? Or am I off base?
Well, specifically about Mexican Bus Ride, Boonwell said, it's guilt that we must escape, not God. You know,
okay,
and again, that's like contextualizing in a way that's
better than what I came up with. Sure.
But he's also an ironist. So he'll say things like, it's guilt we must escape, not God. But he doesn't shy away from in Viridiana when the sort of id of the paupers is unleashed. Once guilt starts to disappear, it becomes vile drunkenness and rape and insanity and gluttony and really grotesque, terrible stuff. So, you know, I think he's very careful to set these different concepts against each other, that he really believes in irony and he really believes in the essential irrationality of existence. So I think a lot of the time he's careful to not be pinned down, but to place his pieces so precisely that they are an intentional counterpoint to each other.
It's true. At the same time, though, what I think is interesting is he talked about his film L, also known as The Strange Passion, which is a great film that he made in Mexico about a man who marries a woman that he's obsessed with and then becomes insanely jealous that, you know, has these insane ideas that she must be betraying him and that he can't possess her the way he wants to. And what I thought was a crazy thing to read was that Boonwell said he put more of himself in that character, the main character, the male character in L, than he had in any other film. And that just makes me see Boonwell in every Fernando Rey character, Fernando Rey character in Vera Diana, in Tristana, in Obscure Object of Desire, because Boonwell has these, you know, interests, these obsessions that in the films, you know, are fetishes that these characters have, these very earthly temptations and urges that he obviously has himself, that he's
so many shots
them.
Of legs.
Especially of legs. Yeah. But,
the stocking legs on the bed.
So we're staring at Sylvia Pinal and Vera Diana as much as the cousin, as much as the beggars. You know, he has that same, and again, I think you're right, Chris, I think that if he wasn't an ironist and couldn't, you know, make us realize where the line is and where it is, where it goes too far and when things start to fall apart. And if he didn't have that idea that, you know, rock and roll means ultimate damnation for everybody, then, you know, we would think that he was just a huge pervert.
Yeah, he's like a chaste pervert. That's one of the things I find really strange about him, is that, like, he's deeply wrapped up in his fetishes, but he's not a fetishist. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. There's something very strange about him.
Well, I mean, we were just talking about the uncle character. Like, he wants to have sex with his niece and, you know, dresses her up. And it's very fetishistic, the way he makes her wear the dress. And he has it all planned out. But the guilt kind of kicks in and he can't actually fully realize it, even though, like,
Yeah. But it's also a kind of Bronte sister tragic romanticism, mm-hmm. that he wants to dress his niece up in the wedding gown that his beloved wife was wearing the night she died on their wedding night.
Even the portrait where the wife looks like her, that's very, like, gothic literature, yeah. kind of a...
Yeah, it's very Edgar yes. Allan Poe was, like, the impression I had this time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or, you know what it kind of reminded me of in, don't judge me too harshly, but it kind of reminded me of, like it's not a thriller, but like a Henry Georges Clouzot kind of a thing. Like some of the images, like the jump rope, how that's the rope he hangs himself with, and that's the rope that goes on the yeah. The rapist's pants. Like, yeah. you know, that almost made me think of, like, that could be the kind of symbol that you might see pop up in, like, a Diabolique or something like that. You know, like, it had that kind of a feel to it sometimes, the way these motifs built on previous images and take on this sort of, like, yeah. you know, horrific quality, or I don't, like...
No, I can see that, except it's so hard for me to connect Bunuel de Clouzot, who feel like aesthetic, in terms of, like, their philosophical moral aesthetics, complete opposites. Like, Clouzot really thinks humanity is the fucking pits and the worst. Like, Clouzot really thinks people are the worst, and I don't think Bunuel thinks that. I think Bunuel really likes people.
Yes.
That he's amused by them and enjoys them even at their worst.
I'm just thinking, you know? Like, William Friedkin, because I think, like, Clouzot actors and... Oh, like, and of course he remade Wages of Fear.
Yeah.
You know, and that has... That has a Bunuel actor in it.
Francisco Ribal, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
right. You know, so, like, I was almost thinking, like, Friedkin must be a Bunuel fan when I was watching some of the images, like the...
You don't know... Do you know the French Connection story?
No.
John, would you like to tell it?
For the villain in the French Connection, he said, I want that Spanish actor from Vera Diana. And so his, you know, whoever the studio, whatever, sent out... And he wanted Francisco Ribal specifically. Mm-hmm. So he went to the airport to pick him up, and it was Fernando Rey. And so they're driving back, and Fernando Rey tells him, you know, I don't speak French at all. And so then he calls and says, no, get me the other guy, Francisco Ribal. And they're like, Francisco Ribal not only doesn't speak French, he doesn't speak English. So he got stuck with Fernando Rey, but...
Yeah. Stuck with Fernando Rey, giving an iconic performance in an all-time acknowledged classic.
Classic film. But, like, no, you can almost see him, like, peeking job. Through some of these images, like, you know, there's the exorcism that comes up in the...
Simon of the Desert,
but also, like, in Nazarene, the seizures, like, that almost reminded me of something, like, in The Exorcist, the way she's moving her body and arching her back, like, yeah. you know, I was thinking, like, it kind of looked like, I don't, just that the way I was watching these films, like, I thought, like, oh, you can see, like, Friedkin kind of peeking through some of these images. And I don't know where the Clouzot wires got crossed in my head, but
I think Clouzot's a good I think style wise I agree with you that especially watching these movies, like, Viridiana has something, its feel is diabolique to me in a way I can't put my finger on. And Mexican Bus Ride and Wages of Fear have a similar feel, just in terms of their landscapes.
Yeah, when it's going up the mountain, and I think it's the front of the bus just has that same designed to it as the trucks they use in Sorcerer, or like the Wages of Fear. You know, it has that design on the front that, like, you immediately kind of connect it seeing it going up and through the water, like,
yeah, and it feels like they're never going to make it through this. That's one right. of the things I like about Mexican Bus Ride, is it's not a thriller at all, but it feels like, how are they going to fucking get through this?
A couple of his films, like, you know, they're not, of course, they're not genre films, but, like, you can almost kind of make these connections to genre cinema, or like I've heard a lot of people kind of compare some of the Mexican films to like a tradition of Mexican melodrama that they kind of fit into. Or sure. Nazarene, like I kind of thought, you know, of course it's not a Western, but just because of some of the locations and settings, and it's this kind of wandering, I'm going to help people wherever I go. It's like the reluctant gunfighter kind of, you know, like there's a little bit of that, enough to make me feel like I had an easier time watching some of them than the ones that are a little bit more
freeform.
I guess so.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. It's one of those, there's a, I forget, there's like a Catherine Deneuve quote that's all about how people think of Buñuel as being this completely unstructured writer, but that his screenplays are the best screenplays she ever read in her career.
Yes,
he's an incredibly precise screenwriter. And I think that's really true. I think you see that in Viridiana and Nazarene, in Diary of a Chambermaid, which has a phenomenal script.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I hadn't heard the quote before, but like it only really occurred to me this time watching through that there's a structure to these films. Like I think just because of the way people talk about Buñuel, and especially in film school, the way you kind of hear him discussed and explained, you almost expect for his films to not
make first
sense.
Two.
Like
yeah, but the first two, Andalusian Dog and L'Âge d'Or, are
right.
that. They really
they are
intended
that.
To be. Yeah. Not readable.
Well, and then, like, you know, you get to something like Phantom of Liberty, and it's very stream of consciousness, kind of like it flows from one character to, like, it's almost like a surreal Shortcuts or something.
Yeah. Well, to me, it's more like a sketch comedy movie, but sketch drama. Is
right.
what I think of with Phantom
sure.
of Liberty is it's like, again, because I can only ever talk about Monty Python, apparently. It reminds me of like that. It's just where one sketch bleeds into another, like Mr. Show or something is what I think of with Phantom of Liberty. But Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie has an incredibly complicated and delicate script. Its Chinese box dream within a dream structure is so incredibly well put together. And I think that that's true for most of them, that they have really tight scripts. Milky Way and Phantom of Liberty, I think, are the two big exceptions. Although Milky
looser,
Way has more regular of a structure. Milky Way looks like Godard's Weekend. It's like Time is Broken movie, where they keep wandering in and out of time periods. I read an interview with an interviewer once where the interviewer's like, but everything in it could be explained rationally. And Buñuel's like, what are you talking
time
about?
Traveler.
He hears the gunshots and somebody else's thought when the Pope is being executed. Like, what like, what are you talking about?
I would love to hear their explanation.
He's like, well, one of the guys says there could be a gun range nearby. And Buñuel's clearly like, yeah, whatever. Whatever, bro, is exactly what he says. That's the exact quote.
Some people, the way they try to not even literalize his films, but over-explain this thing that's very apparent.
Dude,
you know,
I was saying to John just today, I feel like I'm really excited to have this conversation. I feel like almost all of my encounters with people talking about Buñuel are like baby's first Buñuel conversation. Like, I don't know what it is where it's like, I can't believe like the French ones are the only ones that exist. You
yeah.
know? Like
yes.
those are the only ones people want to talk about. And then they have this like, and you know, he's got a leg fetish, you know? And it's
sure.
just like, can we please move on from that?
I mean, for me, this is a little bit like baby's first Buñuel. Like, I'd seen a number of his films before, but you could probably guess
well, I'm trying
which
to
ones
bully
without
you.
Me. I,
That's
well,
all
I
I'm
appreciate
trying to do
you pulling
you.
Me into this because, like, I don't know. I didn't even realize that the Mexican bus ride existed. I know he's got, like, 30-something films, and, like, you only ever hear about that same handful, and there's, like, only so many times I'm going to rewatch Belle du Jour, you know? But, like, I love Nazarene. Like, I really, really love it. And it seems like for a while, maybe that one had more... I don't think it's necessarily that its reputation's declined. It's just, like, you know, probably due to availability that people just don't watch it, don't know about it right
now. Well, Tarkovsky called it the third best film of all time. You know, I mean, if that's not, like, a good enough recommendation to people, I don't know what is, you know?
That's a great endorsement, yeah. For me, just one of the biggest surprises is that, he's a really good storyteller. Like, that sounds almost stupid to say for somebody who's considered one of the great filmmakers. Like,
yeah,
know.
But that's the number one thing that gets lost about him. That's the number one thing I'd say, is that he is, especially once he teams up with Carrière,
yeah.
is that he is an exquisitely in control of his stories.
you sort of forget that what you're watching is strange, even though you have people drinking bloody water and you have I don't know. Have you seen Living in Oblivion?
Yeah.
Or, you know the speech Peter Dinklage gives about, like, oh, I've never seen dwarves in dreams, just in shitty movies, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you know, almost...
The Conversation? That's why I can't like The fucking Conversation. The goddamn, well,
it's even
dream
like,
dwarf.
It's even in, like, Solaris. It's like, oh, like, yeah. Here comes the dwarf. You know, and it was mostly directed at David Lynch, but, like, watching Nazarene, you have the dwarf actor, and, like, he's a real character, and you feel a lot of sympathy for him when he's trying to, you know, get this woman's
attention.
Pick up
the hideous prostitute.
Well, you know, when he's like, oh, you're ugly, but I love you.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's great, and it's a character, and it's fleshed out, and it's not... Like, that was almost my worry, is, like, going in deeper into Bunwell, like, oh, like, is it going to be, like, dream dwarfs and, like, jokes at people's expense for not having legs or something like that, you know? And yeah. It's not that at all.
But, you know, Bunwell talked a lot about people... when they talk about the surrealists, get really focused on dreams. Mm-hmm. And Bunwell would say that I'm more interested in reveries, which are daydreams, because you can direct them. You're simian control of your reveries. And
right.
That those are more interesting to Bunwell than dreams are. And I think his films play like reveries, mm-hmm, far more than they play like dreams. Although he does have some of the best, I think, in terms of being most accurate, dream sequences I can think of, like the strangely terrifying chicken in Los Olvidados, you know, like,
sure.
But I think a lot of the time he's not trying to reproduce a dream feel. I think he's after something different. I think he's more about consciousness and sort of an unmoored consciousness that penetrates like some great global sense of time and history and religion and God.
I think he definitely wants to distinguish his dream sequences from just the strange stuff that pops up in the movies, the way that he goes into a person's face in Mexican Bus Ride before the fantasy starts and the dream sequence starts and, you know, loses focus on his face to, you know, denote that he's going into his mind, you know, rather than some of the weird stuff that he's going to be putting in by himself, the reverie, as it were. So I think he's definitely wants to distinguish, and even in Discreet Charm, which has a very strange, loose quality where it cuts to them on the road and all these different images that have nothing to do with the narrative, he definitely lets us know when a character is talking about a dream they had or is talking about, you know, a fantasy or something that was disconnected from everything else. But the amazing thing is that in that film, everything feels the same. It has the same feel from one segment to another.
He's also good at finding images that exist in reality, like, you know, these sort of realist images that have, you know, some sort of connection to the unconscious mind or, you know, connection to the absurd.
Yes.
The scene Raquel in Mexican Bus Ride.
Oh my God.
God.
I know it's before Raquel Welch, but I immediately thought of, like, of course her name's Raquel.
Yeah.
You know, like that scene where it sort of turns into the dream when he's driving, and like it's full of foliage, like the jungle comes into the bus.
Oh,
and
so great.
He's brushing her hair and kisses, like, that's so beautifully done. That's one of my favorite
scenes. It's so intensely erotic. One of the craziest audience experiences I've ever had. I programmed a series and we showed Viridiana in it, and I watched Viridiana with a sold out audience. It was small theater, so it was 80 people for a sellout. But when Fernando Rey is going to pull her shirt open, It was like a shot of electricity went through a circuit in the audience. Like, I've never felt a group of people simultaneously like get, it just felt like getting electrocuted. It was so intense. And that moment I find to be really intense. And there's no nudity and nothing happens. He immediately covers her up. But it's so much more intense than, like, you know, there's moments in Milky Way where there's, like, you know, total nudity that's very casual and doesn't penetrate your consciousness in the same way.
Or, like,
way.
At the end of Simon of the Desert, when the devil's just got her breast hanging out. And I, like, before, when she's trying to seduce him, she comes, like, dressed as the, like, she calls herself the innocent schoolgirl. And that's sort of almost like a joke on seduction, you know, like... It feels like it's meant more to be funny, you know, when she's licking Adam and like
Simon of the Desert is a comedy.
It's hilarious.
Point blank.
But she comes back disguised as a god, and she's got the beard and her hair curled like Zeus, and then she kicks the lamb, and I don't know why that made me laugh so hard when it goes flying off.
You know what shot cracked me up? It was watching Viridiana this time when there's the rat in the attic and somebody off camera throws the cat at the rat to show that like the rats, you know, got to watch out for the cats. But somebody just like Inferno style hurls a cat on from off screen.
And of course, that all goes back to the hero of Lodge Door kicking the dog randomly.
Yeah. Right. Or La Suerte shooting the goat to get it to fall off of the mountain. Sometimes the goats are not so steady-footed.
The goat tumbles off. It's I don't know. Sorry, people who like animals.
Yeah, but it's also his movies are about animals too, in an interesting.
Well, also like Viridiana when he goes to help the dog, like that's such a great little moment when he's saying like, "Why can't the dog ride in a cart?" And the guy says, "Well, he's a dog," and he actually buys the dog and. Because, like, up till that, you think, oh, like, maybe he's kind of a callous guy, because she's totally invested in these group of people that she's taking care of, and he's like, oh, they're bad news, they're going to turn bad, but, you know, then he goes and helps this dog who's being dragged along with the cart.
Yeah.
And then misses the dog that is being driven by a cart right behind him. I think, you know, besides the irony of, you know, his character disapproving of what she's doing with the beggars, beyond that, what I think Boonwell is interested in Nazarin and Simon of the Desert are how ungrateful people are, how little you're going to change the world with your kindness. And how, you know, the dialogue between the dying woman, the plague victim in Nazarin, where he's bedside and trying to get her to, you know, accept God. Right. And she wants her boyfriend there. She doesn't want him there. She rejects the idea of heaven because she wants this earthly, pleasure of her husband being or her boyfriend being beside her,
the comfort,
as she's
the
dying.
Human comfort,
the human
I don't
comfort.
Think to even
And Simon of the Desert, same thing. The moment that we all know and love when he gets his hands back and immediately uses them to slap his child, because that's what you do with your hands. It's just business as usual. It just goes back to, you know, the world as it is. So like, you know, something as miraculous as that happening just gets completely tossed off, because then you're just, it's just life again. You're just kind of continuing your life, and that dog is still going to be tied to the cart.
Right.
One quote I wanted to throw out, because we were talking about the insects and the animals. I came across a Boonwell quote recently, which I really loved. It really struck me for some reason this time, which is that he says, like, I can't remember the context, but he says, "Even the regular housefly, which I find to be as mysterious and compelling as a fairy." And it's like, that I feel like is animals in his film, is that he comes across animals and finds them to be really mysterious. And that's why he puts the insect on screen. That's why he has Simon of the Desert tell the grasshopper to go spread the gospel.
Right.
Is I think that Boonwell really finds animality, human animality, strange.
And how he has Don Jaime save the bee from the water.
He would have drowned.
The bee would have drowned if it wasn't for me.
Right. He can't help but taking credit for saving the bee's life.
But I think he studied insects right before he became involved with Dali and art and all that. Like, wasn't he studying to be
an entomologist?
Entomologist.
Yeah, I think he studied it. I don't know if he was seriously thinking about making that a career, but I did. I did read that. But he has a great fascination with animals. It's funny when you apologize to the animal lovers out there. We forget that this is a man whose career was started by slicing the eye of a cow. You know, sure. I mean, that was like the first image that announced him into the art
followed
world.
Up by a Clash of the Titans scorpion duel to the death.
Yes.
Yeah. The sequel. But I do think he has a medievalist relationship to animals, that he does have a sense of like, humans and animals are different.
They're here for use, and they're different. Yeah, like he doesn't anthropomorphize them.
It's that animals get slaughtered and eaten, and that's the way it is. I mean, he describes the village he grew up in the mountains, as being untouched and no different than it had been since the Middle Ages until World War One happened. So he was born in 1900 and just had that sense of the world the whole time. I think that he is deeply conservative in some fundamental way. I mean, there's the famous quote of, you know, my loathing of science and technology will someday drive me back to this absurd belief in God. I think that he really does hate telephones and computers and radios and rock music and all of that stuff in a way that he doesn't hate the idea of the woodsman in the 1300s who's, you know, goes to church and has a clear place and peace with God. You know what I mean?
I sure. think that. I mean, when I mentioned that, I thought, like, you can tell that there's some sympathy for the Father Nazario. Like, that's, you know, like, maybe more on that level than as a religious figure. I don't know, but like somebody who tries to live as simply as he can.
Well, he's able to, like, see the absurdity of living that kind of a chaste life and trying to have these very old traditions, these old religious traditions implemented into a village that's just now getting electricity, right? But he sees at the same time the horror of this electricity being installed and these, like, you know, these new times taking over. And the same as at the end of Vera Diana, where they're getting electricity put into the house, right? After she's officially rejected her, you know, her mission, and they're going to just be living the way they are.
One other thing, sorry, I was just thinking about, to kind of jump topics a little, that I wanted to talk about with Milky Way that really struck me this time watching it is when we're talking about, like, what are his attitudes towards these belief systems. And there are two scenes in Milky Way that really struck me this time. One is the priest who turns out to be crazy, who's talking about what the Eucharist is and what its nature is. Right. He changes his opinion. He goes from believing one thing that it's certain, then immediately believes another thing. And then when he gets when the second one gets contradicted, he slaps him and sort of loses, the guy who's contradicting sort of loses his mind. And then the other one is the dualist. It's like a Jesuit and a Jansenist.
Janniist, I think.
Janniist.
Or Jansenist? I don't know.
I think it's the
I've never heard it said out loud.
They're those people who believe, like, even a fly can't be killed.
Well they're having this argument about, like, determinism and free will.
Yeah.
And they're having a duel over it. It's such a great scene.
But then by the end of the duel, they're friends again.
Yes.
Right? And they have this, but the point of their duel is this very obscure, hard to parse disagreement about minutiae that they feel like killing each other over. And I think what those two scenes are showing with Boonwell is that, you know, John, you had told me the quote that I hadn't read from him of the difference between belief and non-belief is nothing, essentially, is what the quote is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just our belief and our ideas about the importance of belief and what we believe are capricious and out of control. That's the Brothers Karamazov quote, right? Ivan believes or he does not believe, but he does not choose, mm-hmm. right? That's a fundamental nature of faith, is you can't will yourself into believing. And how strange that is, because it's a matter of life and death for people. What you believe is a matter of life and death for you. Even like his precious Marquis de Sade, like mm-hmm. it's a matter of life and death what you believe. And Milky Way, a lot of the idea is that's really strange that we care so much about what we believe because we have no control over it and it's completely capricious.
Well,
right?
You have that scene with the Inquisition where this person just won't recant, you know, and of course they're sent off. And then you have the one priest kind of just start the beginnings of like, hey, why do we burn these heretics?
Yeah, and then go to, hey, I submit.
Right. Yeah. You know, there's a few things in Milky Way I think are really interesting. And it almost feels like him going back to L'Âge d'Or and sort of updating certain things, if that makes sense. Or I don't know. I mean, you would know better than I do. But like, even some of the visual gags, like you know, when you have Jesus about to shave and Mary tells him like no the beard suits you, like it kind of makes me think of like the end of L'Âge d'Or where you have the Jesus figure go in and come out clean shaven.
You know what also struck me too, because Edith Scobe plays the Virgin Mary in this, is that like, oh, this movie's really was a huge influence on Holy Motors in a way that I didn't put together before. Anyway,
I just watched it on Blu-ray, and like she has that really like powder blue dress on, that color that's really hard to get digitally, but
yeah,
and like her eyes are that color, and like she's just There's something a little bit like eerie about her stare. Like I like her presence in the film quite a bit, actually. But like this whole idea of Jesus as a man, you know, when they're debating like whether he was it was heresy to say that it was completely divine. It was heresy to say that he's completely a man, but he's human and divine. So Jesus, after that conversation with the, I think it's the waiters, is showing Jesus jogging and getting winded. You know, it's like immediately like tries to emphasize the humanity of it. Like,
well, like the joke the waiter says, we always see him walking with his hands up very slowly. Or like the scene in Milky Way where he's doing one of his little parables.
Right.
There we go. Little parables. That's very condescending. Where Jesus is doing one of his gigantic, world-shattering, God-endowed parables.
He's late to the parable, right? Or
But he's late. But then he also tells it like the scene is like, oh, of course, everybody's sitting around getting drunk and he does it to get like applause. He's holding court.
Yeah.
He's holding the court. We've seen a lot of people hold court and say things that are smart and sort of win arguments. It's like it puts him in a tradition of like, you know, of a lot of public intellectuals who are in some level showing off their smarts.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? In a charming and funny way. And that feels very unsettling and blasphemous to just realistically render how these parables would have been delivered, you know?
I think it's a big part of the torment that these characters feel, that they have to be so right in these convictions, you know, that they have to be so correct in their beliefs that...
And they can't live up to them.
Right. Yeah, sorry, well, just like I was going to say Andara, but I mean Beatrice in Nazarene, when she is told by her mother that she loves him as a man, not as a, you know, messianic figure, that it's shattering for her, that she just has this human urge for him, you know, that she doesn't actually have this religious belief, that she doesn't actually following this clean path, that it's just going to be another obsession of hers, another boyfriend of hers, or Simon of the Desert, basically, you know, being anything else being wrong, you know, is going to just... Let's get on the plane and head out to the nightclub. Why not? Because, you know, it's and he sees there in the nightclub that same thing where nothing he's done has mattered. You know, if we're all heading toward the radioactive flesh, you know, then why bother even standing on one foot as long as you can if ultimately it's not going to make any difference?
Mexican bus ride coming back and finding that the mother's already died and the siblings have got the will.
That's a strange ending, I have to say.
I like it. I don't. I'm going to have to think more about it, probably, because the only article I found that wrote anything about it, Chris, was yours.
Yeah. So,
like, I looked on the internet, and that was the only... Like, I wasn't looking for through your site at all. And it just...
Well, that's part of the outrage, though, about all this, is most, if not all, of his Mexican films are just as good as his French movies. And I think... You know, when you go through like El, The Strange Passion, Mexican Bus Ride, Illusion Travels by Streetcar, Criminal Life of Archibald De La Cruz, Robinson Crusoe, that just, those are just off the top of my head. Those
El
are
Bruto.
All as, yeah. Well, El Bruto is, there's a few, I think El Bruto and Susanna are like a step down, probably.
Oh, I didn't realize we were just naming the good ones. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say the ones that are as good as his very best, let alone the famous Mexican ones like Exterminating Angel and Simon of the Desert and Nazarene. But Nazarene's forgotten. You were saying that earlier, that it doesn't have the reputation. I think that's absolutely true. I think you could poll a bunch of people who claim to be big Buñuel fans and ask them if they've seen Nazarene, and the answer is probably no. You know, it's never, I think it's only on VHS, right, John? Weren't you saying that there's no DVD of it?
That's correct.
You're not under deposition. Feel free to jump in with other...
That's correct.
And I think that the Mexican films are outrageously overlooked. I think that the best ones are as good as anything he did. Like, I'd put El against any of them. I'd certainly put it against Belle du Jour or That Obscure Object of Desire. I think it's unquestionably on that level. Don't you, John?
Well, without a doubt. Criminal Life of Archibald De La Cruz is great.
That one is great as well. That's one I get a lot out of. And so I think that, you know, it is like, you can, you know, Mexican Bus Ride, it doesn't surprise me that nobody's written anything about it, because I think people just don't even... they just treat the Mexican films like, oh, that's when he made more commercial movies, which is somewhat true, I guess. But
do you think that some people look at those films, since he was in self-imposed exile away from Spain, do you think people look at those films as like, well, he did the best he could with what he had? Do you think they have that reputation?
Yes, I think that's exactly it. And I think that the best he could with what he had was awesome. I think that's the part of it that gets overlooked.
Well, there's also like a rawness to some of them that, like, you know, when you're looking at, like, for instance, in Nazarene, when they're going through that plague-ridden town and you just see the crumbling buildings, and like, you know, there's
they all have great production
design.
It's like
the surrealist emphasis on the realist, right? Like, I remember when I first heard that he had done documentaries, thinking like, how does that figure in? But the more I watch these films, the more that makes sense that he's also worked in documentary and kind of branched out a little bit just from the famous films. You know, there's something that he captures in the life of Mexico and the settings and the people's faces, you know, some of the missing teeth, that, like, you know, there's a lot of character and charm that comes from, you know, the fact that he is doing his best with what he has. Like, that's actually an asset, I think, for some of these films.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, too, if outside of English language film writing, if there might be more, because it does seem like there's an American, North and South American, Spanish language tradition of surrealism that maybe, you know, goes back to him or overlaps with him. I know, like, the Mexican surrealist movement.
I feel like there must be more written about him, because just for the Galdós connection, because Galdós, who wrote Nazarene, Viridiana, and then Tristana, which we haven't really talked about, you know, I've never read any of his books because not a lot of them are translated into English, but he is like the biggest Spanish writer ever. He's like the Spanish Dickens, you know? And he's virtually unknown in the United States. I think you have to be a pretty serious academic to know who he is, let alone to have read much of his stuff. And I think that by the same token, I would bet that that in Spanish-speaking countries, that the Mexican films are treated with the dignity they deserve.
And probably influential, too.
Yeah. Well, I feel like a lot of the major Spanish-language writers like Marquez and Fuentes and Octavio Paz are unquestionably influenced by Buñuel. I think that that a lot of the Central and South American writers and Mexican writers that are like the real titanic figures of the 20th century, there's no question that Carlos Fuentes is a huge Buñuel fan, let alone, I mean, there's quotes from him, but you read his work and it's Buñuel. And I think, you know, a lot of that kind of writing, not necessarily only the magical realists.
Did you know Fuentes' wife plays Andara in Nazareth? He was married to her at the
time? I had no idea. That's awesome.
Oh, she's great in it.
Yeah, she's spectacular. I think she's fantastic.
This is all new to me. Everything is new to me. So yeah. I'm still, like, you know, this episode, I mean, it's not as much of a crash course as the Shoei Imamura film. Like, again, I'd seen some of these before, but I feel like I'd never really, I guess, like, engaged in them or tried to sort of put some of this together in a way that felt like I need to have a conversation about them.
Well, I think audiences are also encouraged to do the, like, they're surrealists, you're not supposed to understand them, turn your brain off thing, you know?
Right.
Or they think they are supposed to have, like, that Lynchian nonsensical quality to them, where if you try and go down a David Lynch rabbit hole, it's real easy to come up with nothing. You know, I think that it's possible to come up with something, but it's also possible to spend a lot of time down there and find nothing. I think that Buñuel, so I think people don't look for the concrete meanings and concrete ideas in them because they've sort of been trained by weird American shit that it doesn't have to add up to anything.
I think there's that. And I also think that famous quote, "I'm an atheist, thank God." I honestly think people look at that quote and think, okay, got it. Like, they just assume that's the flavor of Buñuel, and then all of his films are like, oh, they're pithy and witty, you know, takedowns of religion.
And not like a sort of weird statement about, like, I'm still thanking God, I'm still attached to my religiousness, you know, my religiosity.
Right, they don't see the conflict within that sentence.
Yeah, they think
well, like a lot of the filmmakers that are supposedly inspired by Buñuel don't necessarily have that kind of focus, or I mean, some do. Like I was thinking a little bit of Andrzej Żuławski watching some of these because he was atheist, but he also used a lot of religious iconography. And I think it was the co-screenwriter for Possession was talking about on one of the audio commentaries this story how, in, talking with like French intellectuals, and they were criticizing Żuławski for using religious iconography and religious metaphors in his films, even though he was an atheist. And they said like Żuławski kind of snapped at them and said like, "You do not understand the power of the church," you know, the Polish Catholic.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't believe in it, but he understood that there's a power to it and a power over people.
Yeah.
You know, that I think in that way, I sort of like could almost imagine Buñuel saying something similar.
Yeah. I think it's also an interesting comparison because I think Żuławski is much more about like foaming at the mouth madness than yeah. Buñuel. Like Buñuel is very much about like the kind of madness of like, regular people believe insane things. There's an almost like Errol mm-hmm. Morris quality to Buñuel's madness of like, you give a regular person an opportunity to speak and crazy shit will come out of their mouth.
You
know?
Right.
Well, I think thematically it comes back to, you know, stylistically, how do you realistically depict something surreal? The same question thematically is how do you rationalize a belief in God, you know, mm-hmm. or, yeah. or an atheism when the whole temper of the whole country is God absolutely exists, or this is the exact dogma that we're accepting.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think that also in terms of him depicting dreams, a lot of the time he's simply, he's not in that way, that there's very few mm-hmm. times when he cuts to a dream. And I think in those moments the Los Olvidados dream is the one I always go back to, where you have a dream and it's like that, where it's a chicken flapping furiously and it's really unsettling. Your dreams are full of images that are unsettling, not because they're unsettling images, right? Like a chicken flapping isn't unsettling. They're unsettling simply because they feel unsettling. And I think that that's what he discovers, is that like, to make a haunting dream image, it's not necessarily thinking of like, you know, death standing there with a scythe over, you know, the body right. of your mother. It's like something in Phantom of Liberty, like where the woman with the hat comes in holding the candle and the watch, where there's something very unsettling about that woman, and it conveys something to you about time and mortality and ghosts, right? Mm-hmm. Without being nothing verbal and then dissipating in a way that you're like, God, I wish I hadn't experienced that, you know?
Yeah. Oh, well, like, I mean, what's a really great moment in Milky Way is when the car passes by the hitchhikers and he says, "Oh, I hope it crashes," and then it crashes and you kind of get like, you know, it's sort of actualizing something that you only kind of think about. And, you know, when he sees that the dead person in the car yeah. and that little the devil guy shows up, and
I think it's supposed to be death. I don't think it's supposed to be
or
the
death.
Devil.
Death yeah. could be. I was just, you know, but
handsome hippie. From Belle du Jour.
Right. Well, and the other hitchhiker whose shoes were falling apart gets the shoes off the... like, so they both get what they kind of asked for, like new shoes and the car crash. But like, it's just sort of miserable to see it actualized, and they kind of get out of there as quick as they can.
Yeah. That scene more than any...
Well, Milky Way...
No, I was just going to say, reminds me of Godard's Weekend. But I don't have anything to expand on that. But go on, John.
No. I think it's super important that... you know, Weekend had come out 2 years earlier than Milky Way, and that in the, between them, you know, the student riots in Paris of, you know, May 16th.
Yeah, which
happened.
Were happening when they were filming Milky Way, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know, obviously Buñuel, you know, became, in the later films, became super interested in revolution and, you know, political upheaval. And, but Weekend and Milky Way both kind of share like a similar disjointed, picaresque narrative of a road trip with, you know, characters like, you know, Marquis de Sade and the devil and the Whore of Babylon popping up randomly. And all these long political monologues, within the case of Milky Way, obviously more religiously political monologues. But they're very similar. And you could probably speak more to this, Chris, than I can about Boonwell's relationship with the New Wave, right? He had kind of an interesting, conflicted relationship.
Yeah,
with that.
They all liked him. I don't think he liked them. Truffaut in particular had a lot of nice stuff to say about Boonwell. I think the end of Diary of a Chambermaid is a dig specifically at them, like the jump cut and the Chiop, when the people are yelling Viva Chiop. I think he's trying to connect the French New Wave to French fascism of the 30s and 40s, especially considering that, like Eric Rohmer and Bazin were French Catholics who, of the Chiop variety, Chiop was the prefect of police who had banned L'Âge d'Or and was the surrealist bête noir and was like a real villain. And I think that I don't think Boonwell liked the ways in which they played at being revolutionaries. And to connect the jump cut in a film, in Diary of a Chambermaid, which the only real straight-ahead jump cuts in Boonwell's whole career, to a French mob yelling, "France first, put our country first, vive Chiop," like traditional French fascist anti-Semites of the 30s, right? I don't think that's a mistake at all. And I think that he finds their revolutionary qualities to be childish. I think that you can read quotes from him about it, and it even comes up in Milky Way a little bit, that he certainly doesn't believe in the student revolutions in France in the 60s. And I think he identifies a lot of those people involved in them as being the people who were on Chiop's side when Chiop was coming down on him in the Surrealists. You know, that he connects their intellectual traditions to the ones that have always been anathema to Boonwell and the Surrealists.
I think he like treats them like the beggars almost from Vera Diane, especially considering they end up blowing up the main characters at the end of The Obscure Object of Desire.
Yeah. The end of Diary of Chambermaid is another instance like Viridiana of like, you really don't want unfettered id. If what you're taking from my story is society's rules are illusory constraints that should be rejected, you don't understand what I'm saying. Because an unfettered id looks like a fascist mob. Because these rules are contradictory and hard to follow and almost nonsensical doesn't mean I'm saying unfettered id is the way to go. You know, because it's not.
Well, I was interested like in the influence of Sade. I don't know if he ever talked about it, but like the fact that he named drops Sade sort of so many years apart, and even the films that don't explicitly allude to him, like you have connections to Sade's philosophy.
Yeah, he's definitely, haven't read much him say much about de Sade.
I think L'Âge d'Or ending with the scalps on the crucifix, yeah, right, is exactly what you're talking about the unfeathered head, yeah, you know, resulting in horror and violence.
Specifically with de Sade, though, I was thinking about, I don't think he believes in de Sade as like the god philosopher who's invented a new way of seeing the world. I think he rejects that. I think he believes in him the way he believes in like the history of Spanish heterodoxies, which was the inspiration for Milky Way, or the Golden Legends, which was the book that was the inspiration for Simon of the Desert. I think he finds it interesting, but I don't think it's like an artwork that he really loves as an artwork the way I think he does like Huysmans' Gil Blas. You know what I mean? Where you read him talk about that book and he's like, this is an amazing book. But I think he's certainly aware of de Sade, especially the scene that John talked about in Nazarene where the woman wants her husband instead of
salvation.
That's like the notes between a priest and a dying man.
You know, he specifically has Sade speaking in his own words in Milky Way. You know, he brings him in, and the way he shoots him, it's like he has as much visual authority as at least, you know, Jesus does in the film. He's a major part of it, and it feels like his concept of giving into our nature and that religion is the perversion, that's the perverse part of it. You know, it seems like he's at least playing that or trying to integrate that into, you know, this idea of heresies. And
yeah, but it's also de Sade. That scene ends with de Sade. It's another statement about like your beliefs are capricious.
If God exists, I hate him. Yeah.
Yeah. And but then the woman says, I believe in God, I believe in God. And he gets as angry as any of the other believers do in the movie when they're contradicted.
Yes.
He gets as angry at the girl as anybody who has their weird niche belief about it, you know? And that mm-hmm. movie's obviously about the ways in which Christianity throughout its history is at war with itself constantly. You know, the ways in which Christianity is rife with contradictions and at war with itself. You know, like I was thinking about in Herman Melville's Confidence Man, where there's the guy reading the Bible and he's talking about how you can't even reconcile the New Testament from the Old Testament. And in Confidence Man, he's like, and then I found the stuff, the Apocrypha, and it reconciles it all. But I think that that's about a lot of what Milky Way is about, is like, how can you even reconcile these two halves of the Bible? How can you reconcile any of this stuff with each other? It's a religion that is rife with contradictions and at war with itself. And if you believe one thing and another Christian believes another thing, you go to war with each other, right? You burn them in heresies, you dig up their corpses and burn their corpse for being a heretic because you right. discovered secret papers for them. And Desaad is just as much apt to that as anybody.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that he makes a movie like Vera Diana, which can be conceived as an attack on the Catholic Church, but clearly isn't. I think Vera Diana and Nazarene are, you know, in the same basket, where it's like he actually sympathizes with the two characters, with the lead characters, and it's for it to be rejected, you know, then by Spain and be considered such a blasphemous film, and that they have to bury yeah. a print of it on the farm to preserve it and save it from, you know, Franco.
Yeah,
says a lot for, you know, the kind of film that he was making, but the same that I think that people think today, that he is, you know, just this atheist blaspheme.
Yeah, you know, this mad bomber of anti-religious sentiment.
Right, exactly. It was the same reason that people would reject films that have a lot more compassion and a lot more humanity yeah. than they would, than people yeah. would think.
The background of Viridiana, too, we haven't talked about much, but that was a movie he returned to Spain to make it. He came with Mexican producer Gustavo Alatriste and his wife, Sylvia Pinel, who's an incredibly famous Mexican star. She stars in Viridiana and Simon of the Desert and Exterminating mm-hmm. Angel. She has a meaningful part in. And they returned to Spain to make it. And she does her best with the Spanish accent, although I found it very distracting this time when I watched it, that she was trying to put on the Catalan and tha-tha-tha on everything. I thought it was a nice try. But it got approved by Franco to make this movie. It went before the Franco censorship boards and stuff. And after it showed at festivals and started winning awards, the Vatican saw it, called up Franco and was like, what the shit is this? How did you let this movie get made? And Franco was like, oh, don't worry, we'll destroy all the prints. So Gustavo Trist took a print and buried it on his farm, apparently, where it didn't see the light of day in Spain until 1977. It was made in 1961. And
well, that's why the ending is the way it is, yeah. right? He had to change the ending, but Buñuel, come up with a new ending.
Oh, let me say one thing. Buñuel said that people were like, why did Franco let it be approved in the first place? And Buñuel said, with all that Franco has seen and done in his life, do you think there was anything that would have been shocking in this movie to him? Like, that guy was a vile war criminal fascist. Like, do you think that, you know, the poor people are kind of bad? Like, what do you think would have shocked him in that movie? He's somebody who, you know, his mentor's, you know, catchphrase was Viva la Muerte, you know, like, I don't think Franco was going to be shocked by that film. As for the ending, I think, are you thinking of Simon of the Desert's ending? Because Simon of the Desert is 45 minutes long, famously, and had its end. It ends very abruptly. And I have heard conflicting stories about why this is. The story that gets told over and over is that Gustavo Alatriste ran out of money to finish it, so they just had to cobble together an ending for it. Sylvia Pinel and Buñuel sort of says that. And I think I see where the confusion comes from.
Pinel's version seems a lot more likely.
Likely. Yeah, doesn't it?
It does.
So you know what it is. So you should say what it is.
So she says that it was meant to be one third of an anthology film, showcasing her, that she would play different characters in three different versions, you know, three different stories within one film. And one would be made by Fellini and one would be made by Jules Dassin. But that when she contacted these other filmmakers, they were both like, great, I want to cast my wife as in the main role. And she was like, no, the whole idea sure. is I'm the star. You cast me in the main role. And that even her husband, Alatriste, said, and I want to direct you. And she was like, of course not. Boonwell's going to direct me. He's like, why would Boonwell direct you? And she's like, you're an idiot. Of course I want Boonwell to direct me and not you.
Yeah, and I think the whole – that sounds likely – and Boonwell says there's financial troubles on the movie, and it seems likely
not surprising, yeah.
Yeah, it feels like it was coming together, and they started shooting with, like, verbal agreements from Fellini and Desain, or whatever, and then those other sections fell apart, and they were left with this movie, and I think that's what Boonwell is referring to when he says there were financial problems with the film. I don't think it's this incredibly rich movie producer ran out of money to make a fucking movie. I just don't think that's what it was.
But what Kessler's referring to, though, is that they did change the end of Vera Diana to the card playing scene.
I heard that they just closed the
door initially or something like that, yes. And that was too suggestive, so he had to come up with the also very suggestive card game.
I forgot all about that, but yes, you're exactly right. Was that they just went in, the three of them, and shut the door.
That said, Simon of the Desert might be the best 40-minute film ever made.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like it should be part of something else, but it works so well on its own. Like,
yeah.
And it doesn't...
No, I like that it exists by itself and isn't the best section in a crappy anthology. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, it feels like a feature film with, like, no fat on it, yeah. Which I like. Like, I kind of like the... leanness of some of these films. Like, his films aren't very long. Like, some of the longest ones in this bunch anyway were like hour 40 minutes tops, you know. Like, yeah. A lot of them were, I mean, my
well, my copy
of Mexican Bus Ride might have been shorter than what it was supposed to be. I had like I think it was like 10 minutes shorter than the official runtime, and I was trying to figure out like okay, I know there's some sexy stuff, you know, in the dream scene. Like, was there something?
No, but you
cut out. But
if you were getting the official runtime from IMDb or Wikipedia with more obscure
could be
films,
wrong. Yeah,
couldn't be wrong. I would not trust them point blank.
Right,
they just don't have the right information in there, and how could they? You know,
sure. Or sometimes, like I mean, that's sort of too short to account for 10 minutes, but I know sometimes just going even from the like PAL to the NTSC version, like, you know, it affects the runtime for some of these films.
Of the frame rates are different.
No,
you know, I just wanted to make sure, like, I wasn't like, oh yeah, like I love Mexican Bus Ride. And you're like, what about that scene?
But you know, skateboarding dog. That's my favorite scene in Mexican Bus Ride.
Right. No, he had a perfectly lean 90-minute runtime on all of his early stuff. It wasn't until he got to France that the movies became, you know, an hour and 40 minutes long.
Yeah, that they got into that 102, 105 groove.
Yeah, which even then, like, that's not bad because it's so, like, you know, little vignettes, like, that's easy to digest as you're going along. But, like, again, like, Viridiana, it's not a thriller, but it's paced like a thriller, you know? The way it sort of builds
well,
to that climax.
Well, that's why I'm curious what the Galdós book is like, because any of the descriptions I've ever read of Galdós, they just sound like melodramas. And I'm curious if the book plays more like a regular story, you know? I'm curious what Boonwell did with it. Although anytime I read a description of one of them, I was like trying to find a Galdós to read, and it's like, one of his most famous is Marianella, which is about a blind guy who's in love with a woman. He gets his sight back, but she's ugly, so he doesn't want to marry her. And it's like, ugh, well, get this out of me. In the same way Dickens makes me go like, ugh,
well,
get this away from
most often
from
I've
me,
heard
you know?
Galdós compared to Balzac. Which would make perfect sense when you think about like what French filmmakers like Renoir did with Balzac, you know?
Yeah.
And you can totally see how like Boonwell, and again, you know, you compare, they both make versions of Diary of a Chambermaid. You can see how Boonwell would be given a Balzac type melodrama and be like, well, I'm gonna Boonwell the shit out of this.
Yeah. But let me make a U-turn on the conversation. I've been thinking a lot too about, and I'm curious, John, what you think about this. Why, both of us not having read any Galdós, why he made three movies out of those books. And I think it just has to be he could get them funded. There's nothing about them that seems like oh, there's the imprint of another artist in there. I just think it's like the way you can get Dickens or Bronte or Robinson Crusoe funded, that Boonwell went where the money was a lot of the time, especially in the Mexican phase before he had reestablished himself as like a powerhouse director. It's easy to forget that he spent a lot of time in the wilderness, and that until you know, ironically, the French New Wave guys started pushing for him, he was a bit of a forgotten entity. And I think that he, you know, probably went to Galdos just because those were movies that were getting made.
It's hard to say. I mean, Vera Diana, the title of the original book wasn't even Vera Diana. It was something else. So I don't know.
Slam Dunk Ernest.
Something like that. It was name recognition. I don't know how important it was. And Fuentes also talks about Galdos like he's the shit, you know, like who wouldn't want to adapt this brilliant, you know, guy. So it's up in the air without having, you know, enough knowledge of Galdos and his reputation in Spain. I really couldn't say. I mean, it's not like Boonwell ever made like Don Quixote or anything like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, but there is
stuff but, that but I, he talks I about Robinson like, yeah. Crusoe and Wuthering Heights as projects that were brought to him, you know? That...
Yeah.
Do you think it's also just the period setting that he was drawn to? Or...
Hard to say, because he talks a lot about he changed the setting of, like, Diary of a Chambermaid from Belle Epoque, Spain to the 30s because he had such an idyllic childhood that he romanticized so much that he didn't want to put anything negative on screen from that era that he had romanticized, right? And so I don't know if the era, what would attract him to an era or not to an era. I feel like he likes indeterminate modern times a lot of the times, or like a sort of fantasy version of the past. I don't think there's some era that he has where it's like, I want to talk about this specific era. I think he aims for a timelessness in his films. Don't you agree, John, or am I crazy there?
I think he plays fast and loose with geography and time and space. I mean, you think of Milky Way, how the two pilgrims are basically walking, you know, throughout the time and space continuum throughout the whole thing. So, yeah, I don't think he would be maybe attracted to a specific epoch or anything. I think he was pretty content to do whatever he wanted to do and set it wherever he wanted to sit.
And especially when you consider when, like, he says why he did Robinson Crusoe is the hook he found was, I was really interested in Robin Crusoe's sex life and fantasy life. And that's why he wanted to make that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a bit of Simon of the Desert in that, too. Just the isolation and... anyway.
Yeah, no, he compares them. He says Simon of the Desert is a man who wants to be left alone, and that Robin Crusoe is a man who's desperately lonely.
Right.
And but he does. He compares them. That's a thoughtful comparison that he makes. So you're right to bring it up.
I think that part of that could be, you know, informed by his upbringing, you know, in a very antiquated town. But also, I think, you know, probably wants to create an irony with, you know, the idea of it being the time of Christ, you know, or like, you know, that same sort of that era. What interests me, though, about Boonwell, because he's such a singular artist, you don't usually think of him in comparison to other filmmakers. Yeah. At least I don't.
Yeah, who the hell would you compare him to?
Right, well, that's the thing. But when he's making films and when he's later in his career in the 60s and the 70s, it's interesting to think about things like these revolutionary things happening, like the French New Wave and, you know, New Hollywood and things like that, and all these new styles. And Boonwell obviously is not a flashy stylist. You know, his films are, you know, very straightforward. His camera work is very simple. So in terms of timelessness, I think what I really think about is like the fact that he maintains this very simple aesthetic.
Although he really knows how to move a camera, like those punch-ins, or like there's a lot of camera movement, actually. It's not as...
Yeah.
That doesn't draw attention to
it. For some reason,
itself,
I kind of remember these films, some of them being more static than they actually are. Like, I was sort of impressed a lot of the times.
Well, because he's not trying to show off and... ever. He's not going to have, like, a swooping crane shot and an eight-minute tracking shot and, like...
No.
Jump cuts and cut to, like, the French flag on a wall and bullets and then Anna Karina, you know, in yellow face.
But there's a lot of those, like, camera moving in close, even on the, like, you know, in some cases he kind of exaggerates it, like that painting of the laughing Jesus, that's kind of scary, he kind of punches right in, but a lot of the times it's like this very kind of slow movement in towards somebody's face.
Yeah, well, it's funny, I mean, you think about any filmmaker stylistically and say, what do you think of? You say Scorsese, like, I think of tracking shots, you know, or Orson Welles, I think of, you know, the long opening shot of Touch of Evil. And with Boonwell, it's like he's not distinguished by that style. Specifically, he's just a smart filmmaker. He just knows how to tell the story.
Yeah.
Well, so I was wondering if there's anything we didn't cover that you would like to get into, or...
Well, I've set the bar of this being not a babyish, stupid, basic conversation, so now we gotta live up to it, John. We gotta live up to it. Now's the chance.
Just something that I always think of when I watch Vera Diana, which, again, watching it recently, Chris and I were talking about it, it might be the best one. I don't know. It's so hard to pick,
yeah.
But it's such a great film.
It's pretty great. I think I'm really into it.
I think it's his best one. I think it's close, because John and I were having a conversation about, like, God, how could you even pick the 10 essential Boone Wells? You know, it's really hard, because he has such a varied career in some ways with different pieces.
Also, I've seen hardly all of them, you know? Like, yeah. I haven't seen them all. But just out of this bunch that we've been talking about, like, for me, it's kind of down to Viridiana or Nazarene. And
yeah.
I feel like Simon of the Desert should be in that mix. It's just, like... I don't know if it's because it is 40 minutes.
Well, but that's
that it
John
sort of
and I
like,
were also
oh, like
saying we both probably like Simon of the Desert more than Viridiana.
Right. Like in some ways, just the fact that it's like a little bit shorter and a little bit funnier.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like that's just sort of how I felt about it. But like I think when you identified those three, that made a lot of sense to me, because it does feel like there's some continuum, you know, between them.
Yeah, I agree.
Without a doubt. But watching Vera Diana, Boone Wells being my favorite filmmaker. I think about my favorite.
Yeah, mine too. That also, we got to be on the record. Boone Wells is unquestionably John and I's favorite filmmaker, right?
You guys are the Bunwell guys, which, yeah. I feel like there's a lot of pressure to do this episode for some reason. I don't know if people who are listening would know, but on your Twitter, it's the... Ostrich or Emu from Phantom of Liberty. You guys show so much love to Bunuel and know so much about him that hopefully people are going to get something out of listening to this that that they wouldn't if I brought on somebody and they were like, oh yeah, man, like
that Belle du Jour, huh?
Oh, can I like Belle du Jour's fine, but
Martin, we're on your side. That was another thing John and I were talking about. We did this Jean-Pierre Melville podcast a while back, and John and I were both like, yeah, Le Samurai, it's good. You know, it's good. It's not his best at all by any stretch. It's good.
Okay.
And Belle du Jour is the same way. And people got so angry.
Why do people recommend Belle du Jour as the first one to watch? Like, I keep running into this. They're like, oh, like, that's the starter Bunuel. Like,
no.
You know, after Un Chien Andalou, which, of course, you've seen because it's like, the most important... you know, short, silent, surrealist thing, whatever. But, like, people always say, oh, you're supposed to start with Belle du Jour, and...
Because it was the biggest hit. It's like when people...
I guess
no, yeah, for me, from my experience, right, Le Samurai was the first Melville I saw, and I was like, wow, that is a perfect movie. I know why people love this filmmaker. That's amazing. And then when I saw more Melville, it was like, oh, it's not even in my top five. Same thing with Belle du Jour.
Not even in my
Samurai,
top 10.
Doing something very like he's specifically doing something like stripped down and minimalist, and like people assume that's all of Melville.
They assume that's all he is.
One,
exactly.
Really.
They assume that they got everything that there's everything there is to know about Melville in that one movie. Same with Belle du Jour, because I saw it right when Scorsese had it re-released in the mid 90s was my first Boone Wells movie that I saw. And similarly, I thought, wow, bam, dynamite. Never going to see a better movie than that, and I get it. And then again, it was like, as soon as I saw more Boone Wells movies, it was like, oh, it's not even cracking the surface.
And it also is the same thing of giving the false impression where it's like, yeah, Boone Wells, it's dream sequences and kinky sex. Got it.
Right.
You know?
I don't know if maybe you'd be interested in doing a part two at some point, just focusing maybe on the Mexican stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to.
Okay.
Or maybe we could find another theme, you know, in there.
I would love to do that without a doubt.
Yeah, I also don't want to sound like I'm... speaking badly of the late films either. Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie is one of my all-time favorite movies and certainly competes with Viridiana for my favorite Boone Wells.
I mean, we didn't say anything bad about them, did we?
I don't know. I just feel like I've been playing up the Mexican ones so hard that maybe people were getting the impression that the later ones are not as good, and they are.
But well, I think people know that the later ones are great. Yeah. Like, it's just sort of a given that like it's worth... maybe putting a bit of attention on the Mexican ones, that's all. But...
I give him 4 stars out of 4.
You've done that before on this show.
Have I? I'm not good at wrapping anything up. Well, you know what? These are correct and accurate ratings.
Four-star filmmakers.
Four-star filmmakers with Cribs and Funderburg.
Well, thank you. I feel like really lucky.
Thank you for letting us do this, Martin.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And if folks want to find you on the internet, where can they look?
ThePinkSmoke.com. Where you can find us and a lot of Martin Kessler on there as well.
Yeah. If you want to read about some Alexei Garamin,
we're
your number one source for it.
The number one source?
We are. For Mexican Bus Ride and Alexei Garamin, go to The Pink Smoke. You have no other choice.
And just have one request, Martin. If you can, play us off with Les Sinners, the end song from Simon of the Desert.
Stay away from that goat.